Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
Hello, I'm Jim, and this is the XS Long Player, classic album conversations with the people who made those albums. On this episode, we're going to be discussing the debut album from one of the most important music makers, in my opinion, of the last couple of decades, Badly Drawn Boy, Hour of the Bewilderbeast. This was, when it came out, a genre-busting album that came right off the back of the Britpop era and did something musically that a lot of the indie lads and lasses hadn't heard until this point. It was first published in the year 2000, which means it's just celebrated its 20th anniversary, which makes me feel really old, and was instantly recognised at the time of its release for being the great piece of work it was. It went on to win the 2000 Mercury Music Prize, which we talk about with Damon on today's show. But thankfully wasn't one of the artists and albums that went on to experience the curse of the Mercury Music Prize. If it's been a while since you've listened to The Hour of Bewilderbeast, and you need to remind yourself of how the album flows and the intermissions and all that kind of thing, I've stuck a link to listen to the album in the podcast description. Go and have a listen to that either before you continue or maybe right at the end, because hopefully this conversation will inspire you to go and rediscover that brilliant album. So let's get stuck into it. Hour of the Bewilderbeast with the boy himself, Damon Goff. This is the XS Manchester Long Player. How are you doing, Damon?
Hi, Jim. I'm fine, thank you.
Good. 21 years we're going back for this one. Does it feel that long?
Oh, yeah. Easily. As we all know, time's a weird thing, especially in the last year. We've all experienced how time can play tricks on you. And it depends on what your reference points are. But for me, the first album feels like so much has happened in my life since. I did like eight albums in 12 years in the first part of my career, really. And then I had a big break. So one thing and another has made it feel like, I can't say it feels like yesterday. Then again, parts of it do, little bits of it do. It depends what your memory tells you.
Does it feel like, I mean, a lot of people tell me that the music they write, it's so connected with where they were at a point in their life when they wrote it, that it's almost like a diary entry. So when you look at the music from Hour of the Bewilderbeast, is it kind of like looking back at a reflection of yourself at that stage?
Yeah. I think inevitably is that, particularly with that first album, it was my first attempt at making a full album, and after the first EPs that I'd made at the time. And I wanted to do something with a bit of weight to it, that to put myself on the map, really, because I felt like the EPs I'd done were just me kind of dabbling and trying things out. So I wanted to make a statement. All I had to draw from was my life up to that point. And I wasn't aware of it, but that the album took on a kind of a mirror of the relationship at the time of me. I'd just met Claire, and she was the mother of my two children. We're not together now. We broke up sort of 10 years ago. We're still kind of close because the kids are part of us. But the album just turned into a song cycle about my struggles up to that point in life of trying to make sense of the world and relationships and myself. I mean, the title itself, Bewilderbeast, was a reference to me being constantly unsure of where I fit into the world, I suppose. So I think the honesty that's in the album is probably what has given it its longevity, and those kinds of emotions are always going to be relevant. I have a different set of emotions now, perhaps 20 years later. I'm a 20-year-older version of myself, and things I've learned and unlearned. So it's definitely a moment in time, that album, that when I listen to it, it does take me back to a kind of an innocent time for me personally. And this, the great thing about music, as we all know, it you hear a song and it just transports you immediately to a point where you heard it or what was going on in your life at that time.
It's interesting you mentioned the honesty of the album, because I was watching an interview you did, and I think it was about 2000 when the album first came out, which incidentally is the only time I think I've ever seen you without a hat. And you said in it that you didn't think you were a very good singer, but you were honest with your singing, and that gave the album something a bit special. When you listen back to the album now, do you still feel self-conscious about your voice and your singing?
I feel self-conscious about my voice now. I mean, the next record I make, I've got to refine my voice. I mean, the confidence that I need to perform any songs. There's certain songs on Bewilderbeast that I listen to and think, oh, I could have sung that better. And I do sing better now. When I perform the songs live, I think my voice has matured. It's not changed dramatically, but it's matured a little bit. And my technique's probably improved over the years because I've done so many gigs. But certain songs on the Wildebeest, I kind of nailed it. But I remember a song like Once Around the Block, for example. I remember thinking that song was finished. And then it was one of the few songs where A&R stepped in. Nick Worthington, who was a really great A&R guy at XL, he just said, one of the few occasions where he said, I think you could sing this better. I think he knew how good the song was. And he was right to call it, because I think I remember listening to a previous take that I'd settled on being the final one, and it was nowhere near good enough, really. Things like that come with experience. It's like, I police myself these days when I do some vocals. I'm pretty hard on myself to get it right. And even then, you don't get it right. With reflection, a few years down the line, you still think you could do things better. And I met, like, the song Spitting in the Wind, I'll use that title, that version of the title, rather than... I remember that song in particular, that the vocal on that. And a friend of mine said to me years down the line, after the album had been out 5, maybe 10 years, I can't remember. And I said, oh, that song, it always kind of embarrasses me, the vocal take. And they said, well, no, that's the evolution of an artist, though, that's quite precious. And I thought, well, I'll take that as a positive, because the person I was talking to was an artist, a painter, and they said that that's part of an artist's evolution, is to accept those flaws in earlier works, and you've progressed through your latest. It's part of the journey, really.
At the time, I remember hearing the album for the first time. One of the things that drew me to it was the almost unaffected honesty of the vocals. And the whole album just felt like something very different to what had come before. Did it feel like that at the time? Did it feel like you were making something that was unique, that didn't reflect kind of the previous 10 years of music? Because it was coming off the back of like Britpop and whatnot.
Yeah, well, I mean, being in Manchester in the mid-90s with everything that was kicking off, with obviously Oasis were just dominating the world, and that was exciting for Manchester as a place to be in. But I'd always felt that connection to Manchester with earlier bands in my life, the Smiths and the Fall, the Manchester scene and Joy Division, New Order. There was always something in the air, and I already felt different being a solo artist. So when I was doing these strange gigs that I was heavily criticised at the time for being pretty rubbish, but I kind of thrived on that. I thought, well, I'm not trying to represent this thing that Manchester is associated with. I'm trying to be another kind of arm of it, another facet of what Manchester has to offer. So I immediately stood out. To some people, I wasn't a good thing, and to others, I was the greatest thing because it was different. That helped initially get me noticed, I suppose, looking back. But I suppose just the singer-songwritery thing generally wasn't that represented in Manchester at the time. And with Twisted Nerve and other bands that we had, it became like an acoustic movement, the new acoustic movement, which I kind of didn't really feel that we'd instigated anything new or fresh in that department. It was just guitars still. But I suppose the whole madeness of Twisted Nerve and me, that was an aspect of it, that there was something raw and honest about that. And that tied in with my love of lo-fi in the early 90s with artists like Beck and Pavement and Sebado, Guided by Voices, bands that a lot of American indie bands that I really loved at that point. And so indie homemadeness made sense to me as an aesthetic. So yeah, but again, all these things are like, they're just happening without you knowing. And you either capture a zeitgeist or you don't. And every time you do something, you want to feel like you're at the cutting edge of something important. And you have to ignore it all to get on with your next work. You have to kind of ignore and absorb at the same time.
I mean, I guess part of the fact it was so new might have caught you off guard that it was also so successful. It won the Mercury Music Prize, had phenomenal success in terms of sales as well. And I remember seeing on Top of the Pops at the time a couple of times too. You always struck me as someone who loves music, but isn't necessarily that bothered about all the bells and whistles that come with the fame. side of things. So how did you cope with that being shoved straight into the limelight?
It's a really difficult tightrope to walk, the fame game, and claiming that you don't like it, that fame isn't for you, but you're still there. You know, as a byproduct of being a musician that gets a certain amount of success, like with me, like you said, the Mercury Prize and playing live and being on TV shows, you inevitably look like a hypocrite if you say you don't like it. And I never really understood those people that would turn up to award ceremonies, especially like the NME Awards, and pretend like they don't want to be there, but they still walk up and get their award and walk away with it. Like, well, so if you're going to turn up, don't slag off the very thing you're there for. You know, you're getting an award. It's a strange balance to strike. I don't naturally enjoy certain aspects of fame. I haven't really courted it, because if you do, you're going to look silly. I accept the amount of fame that comes with it, because some of it is positive and gives you a platform to help in some ways, which I have done as much as I can, helping different organisations and charities over the years because I've got a voice and a platform. Mm-hmm. And so there's some good with it. But, you know, I couldn't be the kind of person that's on TV every day. There's a certain thing in human nature to want to be noticed and to also preserve your privacy. And that we're kind of all going through that now with social media and the way the world operates these days. It's gone to other levels. But I kind of just toyed with it and got the most out of it as I could in those days. And I suppose the other cliche as well is that, like, I became a heavy drinker throughout those years of touring, because there's nothing else to do when you're filling like 8-10 hours a day before you go on stage, and you're on a tour bus driving through the night in America or Europe or Japan, and I just became a habitual drinker. So that was one of the downsides, but it got me through. You know, it was one of those things that got me through, and I gave up the booze 5 years ago. But so now everything I do when I do a gig or I'm making an album, I'm doing it from another new perspective, which is sober. So we could talk about that forever. You're probably going to have to edit most of this out, because it's not really relevant.
It's interesting, though. Let's shift back to the music. Mm. And on the album, there's a couple of tracks on there that are kind of mini tracks. There's Bewilder, Body Rap. This song is probably on the short side as well. Was there something specific you were trying to achieve by adding in those tunes? Because I think Bewilder is probably one of my favourite tracks on the album. I just love the simplicity of it. And the fact that there's this mini 40 seconds or something like that, isn't it? They're almost like intermissions, I guess. Was there something you were trying to achieve by putting these tracks in there?
I had the attitude of it, like, this is my big moment to make a big statement with a record. And I had so many ideas to try and fit into the one album, but I'd worked with so many different producers as well on different songs that it came a point where I felt, I don't know if this is all working together. There's quite a few different styles going on, which is what I wanted it to be. I worked with different producers for that reason, to get different results out of different songs. And I didn't want it to sound like the same musician that was making all these songs. So part of me wanted to do that, but then I thought, does this hold together? So a lot of the little interlude moments were, some of them were afterthoughts and segues to kind of tie one track to another. Bewilder was, supposedly, I was just playing it on the harmonium, a version of the title track. I mean, the title track itself, Bewilder Beast, is an instrumental, which is a strange thing to choose to do. But I said in a quote last year that I think perhaps part of me wanted a song that was a title track that had no words, because the music was more powerful. There was a notion of that going on. And the little hint of Bewilder that you mentioned was just to say this is coming up later on. This is a little taste of it. I was just playing around with like a sound collage as well. I mean, like, fast forwarding to my recent album, I didn't do any of that. And I really kind of wish I had, because I think it would have ended up stronger if I had. But I didn't want to go there again. I felt like I'd done that. I'm just never really satisfied. Once I've lived with the songs for so long, like you do for 2 years when you're making an album, or however long it takes, to and fro in with making songs, I just couldn't hear anymore. You listen to them and dissected them that many times in the studio that I always want to add something extra when it comes to finishing, just before you're going to master a record. If I can add a few little bits in there that surprise me even. So maybe there was a bit of that going on as well with some of those small ideas.
When was the last time you listened to it? When was the last time you sat down and put Bewilder Beast on?
The last time I listened to it through was Tim's Twitter listening party last year in June. Okay. I haven't listened to it since then. I haven't listened to my new album more than twice. This is, again, another weird admission to make. Since giving up the booze 5 years ago, I struggle to listen to my own music. I just get it done and that's it. I used to sit and listen to mixes in my headphones at night and with a glass of wine or Jack and Coke or whatever. And that's the other thing about the booze that I kind of miss, is that I haven't got the staying power to be in the studio, listen to mixes for hours on end. The booze allowed that to be much more tolerable, and things have changed for me. So I'm listening to the music at the levels I used to. I can't do it anymore. Maybe that'll change again. I mean, I'm in a phase now. The next album I make, I'm kind of excited about what I can do. I've got some really strong ideas, and but yeah, I don't tend to sit and dwell and listen to my. I don't listen to tons of music anyway. I just dip in and out and hear songs when I hear them, and then check an artist out for a minute. And I'm always, if I hear music that I like, I tend to want to just sit at my piano or pick up my guitar. Same if I see a film that's inspiring, I'll immediately be thinking of musical ideas. I get distracted so easily. I can't read a book without stopping and picking up my guitar. So the same with music. If I listen to something that I like, it tends to make me want to pick up an instrument and come up with something.
Where did the influences come from on this album then? Was it art, literature, poetry, film, or was it a mishmash of them all?
Mainly real life, just basic experiences of struggling to find purpose and struggling to find your slot, where you fit in, what you're good at. Relationships were always a struggle for me. I was never really holding a relationship down. Well, that said, I had long relationships that ended. Even when I was 18, I was with somebody for 2 years and then someone for 3 or 4 years in my 20s. And it was never quite what I expected it to be. And so there was the real life stuff that I experienced. And a lot of films, I suppose in my early 20s, I went to the cinema a lot. And so film and music. But I suppose for me, it's always some kind of ethereal, mystical notion that I get from these things. It's not, as an artist, I very much, everything is about feeling, how something feels, how something makes you feel. And so when I write a song, it's all about how it feels rather than the technicality of it or the, I'm not a technically gifted guitarist or pianist, I'm not a technically gifted singer, but the combination of the ideas can clash and make something quite beautiful if you just capture it. And I just thrive on moments really, and guesswork and instinct, and try not to overthink stuff too much, which is impossible for me.
For people like me who aren't musicians, it's a really difficult thing to get your head around, the idea that you can understand how something in someone's life in reality could influence, say, lyrics, for example. But in terms of something that happens in someone's life influencing or creating this feeling of music, it's something that's very difficult for a non-musician to get their head around, I think.
It's hard for me to get my head around because I sometimes, it really is, because there was a point in my life where I wasn't a musician, because I always maintain that everybody's got a song in them, at least one great song. I can vouch for that being true, because if I'd gone down another path, for example, at the age of 18 and got a different job other than in a recording studio, which I did, if I'd gone down another path, a more academic route, I would never have known I could write a song, because it might not have entered my life. And when I first tried to play guitar, I thought, no, I gave up several times. I thought, this just it's just too hard. I can't stand there with this thing in my hand and make sense of it. And now, 20 years later, I feel as comfortable with a guitar as I do with a spoon in my hand eating my breakfast cereal. You know, it's an extension of me. I play it, and that was perseverance. But the thing about coming up with ideas is still a mystery. Even with the amount of knowledge I have of playing my guitar or my piano, I still don't quite get how a song comes to be. Yesterday or the day before, I wrote a song and it came from nothing. I just sat and played and something clicked and it felt right, and I remembered it and I recorded it, and they just come randomly, these songs. But I don't really buy into the thing that a lot of people say, that these things are coming from somewhere else. I definitely work at these things. These ideas come out of my head. They're not God-given. I don't believe in that. I think that's the narrative that everyone has just bought into over. Yeah, there's an essence of truth in being in the moment and feeling good. Ideas happen when you're in the right mood, for example, but I don't think they descend from somewhere else. That takes away some of the credit for you working on it, if you accept that notion.
What's your favourite track on the album? Looking back at it 21 years down the line, is there one that stands out for you? Or is it like picking a favourite child?
I suppose there's something with the first album. There's a few songs that are just... Like the opening track, The Shining, is like, so many people love that intro, and I was so pleased I went with that idea of the way the album begins with the French horn and the cello. That was kind of an afterthought, like an edit, where I lifted those elements from the song and put them at the beginning to create an intro. And so that song's always going to be special, because it's like the first, it's the beginning of something. even though I'd done the EPs before, this was the first album and it was the beginning of my career in a way. That song represents that. So that's always going to be a special one. And Once Around the Block is, I don't know if that song's ever going to be superseded by any others. I mean, I feel like I've written songs as strong as that. But there's something about Everything Went Right. And the Away team that produced that song, Andy and Ian, in Courtyard Studios in Oxford, where Radiohead at their headquarters, they never get really enough mention. Their input was very big on that song, and it was a moment when I recorded that. I felt like, yes, this is who I want to be. This song represents everything I'm trying to become as an artist. So that was a landmark tune, and still is, and it changes over time when I play it live. Songs like Disillusion, the ones that were singles, and Another Pearl, and Epitaph at the end of the album is like just a beautiful closing track. So it's what I'm most proud of when I'm going through the songs now, as you in my head, I'm trying to pick them out. It's like the journey that the album takes. It's quite long, as most albums go, exactly an hour, hence the title, Hour of Bewilderbeast. But the journey it takes you on is something I'm most proud of, because that's quite hard to do. It's almost cinematic. To do it without visuals, it's kind of, you would say, easier to create a journey when you've got like a film to watch. But to do it with just audio is another kind of skill, I suppose, that I'll never match that kind of thing again on an album.
Great album. Been an honour to play it on XS Manchester. Damon, thank you very much for joining us to talk us through it. And we look forward to hearing what comes next soon.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks a lot, Jim. I really appreciate you having me.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.
Thank you very much for listening to the XS Long Player. Classic album conversations with the people who helped make those albums. There's a load more to go at in this series, so make sure you listen to the other episodes. Talking Pills and Thrills and Belly Aches, Happy Mondays, Cortina's St. Jude, Mosley Shoals, Ocean Colour Scene, Hour of the Wildebeest, Damon Goff and Kaiser Chiefs Employment. That's season one. Season two is coming soon. And if you want to get a notification as soon as that podcast series is up, click follow now and we'll send you a note as soon as season two is available. Plus, if you know someone who would love this podcast, maybe we've covered one of their favourite albums, make sure you tell your mates about it. And if you want me to do a specific album with a specific person, then why not get in touch? You can find me on Twitter at Mr_JimBob. But I'll see you next time for the next XS Long Player.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.